I think officially last week was Sanctity of Life Sunday, but we put off our observance of it here till this week. There should be some literature that you received on your way in or should be available as you go out if you didn't get it. Interestingly enough, our postponement, if you will, or our waiting a week to delve into this subject has allowed for some interesting circumstances to transpire in those days. This past Tuesday, Governor Andrew Cuomo of New York State signed into law a radical pro-abortion bill just hours after the state Senate and Assembly in New York passed it. The bill he signed legalized abortion for basically any reason all the way up to birth. Very extreme. We're not talking about legalizing late-term abortions as much as we are talking about legalizing the absolute latest possible moment, the very moment before birth. One writer, as quoted in LifeNews.com, a man by the name of Matt Walsh, made this observation. The new law in New York means that although New York State, prohibits the injection of lethal substance into the veins of a convicted killer, that they allow that same lethal injection into a baby moments before it's born. Why has it come to this? For that matter, why has 60 million babies been aborted since 1973? 60 million. The equivalent to the current population of 19 U.S. states, as you saw earlier. Why? Why will now a fully viable human being, 1 second away from birth in New York State, now be legally killed? Why? There's only one reason. Life itself has been devalued. Devalued as a result of the wholesale acceptance of evolutionary theory, which assumes that man is nothing more than another animal, and therefore subject to be weeded out at any time. Hitler and the Germans justified the Holocaust on the basis of evolution, the same basis. But human beings do possess value. We would all agree, at least those of us here, we would agree that all human beings possess value because they are all the creation of God. David vividly made this point long ago when he wrote Psalm 139. In verse 14 is probably the most quoted and well known of what he wrote in that psalm, where he says, in reference to his own creation, "I am fearfully and wonderfully made." No, he didn't say, "I am fearfully and wonderfully an accident," but "I am fearfully and wonderfully made." It is our creation, it's the creation of mankind that confirms the value of mankind and the value of human life. It is God's involvement in our lives from the time we were in our mother's womb until this very moment. God's intimate involvement in our lives from pre-birth till now. His continual involvement in our lives that demonstrates the value that He places on us as His creation. And that's what David writes about in Psalm 139. And what we want to look at specifically in this psalm is this. How is it that God is involved in our lives? When we say He is intimately involved in our lives from the time we were in our mother's womb till this very moment, what are we talking about? David covers a lot of ground, if not all the ground, in response to that question. First of all, David reminds us that God knows everything about us. We're talking here about God's omniscience, His all-knowing, and wrapped up in that is also God's omnipresence, the fact that He is everywhere. And because He is everywhere, there is nothing that escapes His knowledge. And so David begins, O Lord, You have searched me and known me. The known here is a known that flows out of God's omniscience, flows out of His very being. He knows everything about us. He knows us personally. In verse 1, David says, O Lord, You have searched me and known me, just like He has searched you and me today. It's no different now than it was for David when he wrote that. God knows us. He knows everything about us. He knows the personality He gave us. He knows the physical traits that He gave us. He knows all of our decisions, everything. Nothing escapes His knowledge. He has a full knowledge of us. He knows us personally. And He knows everything we do. Verse 2, You know my sitting down and my rising up. There is nothing we do that He is not knowledgeable of. Knows every decision we make, every action we take. He knows what we think. The latter part of verse 2, You understand my thought afar off. There's not even a thought that crosses our mind that He doesn't know about. That's a very humbling reality when you contemplate it. You comprehend my path, He says, and my lying down, verse 3. Not only does He know us personally, not only does He know all that we do and everything we think, but He also knows every word we speak. In verse 4 He says, And there is not a word on my tongue, but behold the Lord, You know it all together. He knows what we speak, but He knows why we speak what we speak. And He knows the motive behind what we say. He knows every word we speak in completeness, down to the motive, the situation, the circumstance. His hand is always upon us. Verse 5, David says, You have hedged me behind and before. God's hand of protection is upon us. If God had not been protecting us and hedging us behind and before, we would not be sitting here today, probably. We would have already been consumed in some way, physically or spiritually, in this world. But it's because God's hand is upon us and has been upon us from before we were even born into this world. We are sitting here today. You have hedged me behind and before. And believe me, David understood that literally. David fled for many, many months. He and his 400 mighty men in the wilderness from all the armies of Saul who sought daily to kill him. But God hedged him before him and behind. The rest of verse 5 said, And laid Your hand upon me. And He doesn't mean laid Your hand upon me in discipline, but laid Your hand upon me in protection. Such knowledge, says David, is too wonderful for me. It is high, I cannot attain it. Why would God do that? Why would God care so deeply about any sin-touched individual that lives in this world, no matter who they are, because of His wonderful grace, because He values us as His creation, He protects us. And then He knows always where we are. Verses 7 to 12 contain a passage here that became the basis for a poem by English poet Francis Thompson, who lived from 1859 to 1907. That poem, with 184 lines, by the way, this is not in some short roses are red poem here, okay, and violets are blue. This is a long treatise, 184 lines, based on verses 7 to 12, entitled The Hound of Heaven. It became very popular in its day. And it's based on the theme of a sinner's flight from God and God's pursuit of that sinner. And that describes every one of us at some point. In verse 7, David asks, "Where can I go from your spirit? Or where can I flee from your presence?" The answer is nowhere. It's just like a hound pursues a fox. Onward, onward, never ceasing, never quitting, never stopping. God pursues us. Though we run from Him, though we hide for Him, though we do what Jonah did so long ago when he jumped on that ship and headed to the uttermost end of the earth as he knew it. But yet God knew where he was. God sent the storm. And Jonah was flung into the deep and swallowed by the fish. But God was there. God spoke to him. Jonah repented and the fish spit him out. Verse 8 says, "If I ascend into heaven, you are there." No matter how far away or how close, God is always there, everywhere. "If I make my bed in hell," he says, "behold, you are there." Now, he's not talking about the final resting place, the lake of fire. He's talking about the Greek word translated hell here, Sheol, or death. And what that, of course, comprised was a place of suffering, but not the final resting place, the lake of fire, or a place in paradise, as the Lord called it. "If I take the wings of the morning," he says, which means, in a picturesque language here, that David is thinking about looking out over the Mediterranean Sea, clear to the horizon. That was known as the wings of the morning. As far as you can go from the east and the west, as far as you can go north and south, and up and down, you will find God there. "Well, I dwell in the uttermost parts of the sea. Even there your hand shall lead me. Your right hand shall hold me. I say, surely the darkness shall fall on me. Even the night shall be light about me." In other words, light or day, darkness or light, God is there. "Indeed, the darkness shall not hide from you, but the night shines as the day, the darkness as the light." And the light, he says, are both alike to you. God knows everything about us, including where we are at every moment of every day, and including where we were at before we were ever born. In fact, not only does He know where we were at, but He was there with us as an omnipresent God in our mother's womb before we ever were born. And so it is only natural that He turns in verse 13 to the next part of the psalm, in which David discusses God's plans for our existence. His plans for our existence from beginning to end, which began before our physical birth, because our life began before we were born. And so he says this in verse 13, "For you formed my inward parts." All of our internal organs, all of our blood vessels, all of our bones, all of our muscles, all of our substance. You formed my inward parts, says David. You covered me in my mother's womb. You, Lord, you were there. You covered me with the skin that covers those organs and with the features that I possess. I will praise you, says David, verse 14, for I am fearfully and wonderfully made. The very contemplation of the human body is all the evidence anybody needs for the existence of God. The very complexity of our human body is argument for the creation of God. Brother Sam this past fall gave us a discussion of DNA. Fascinating. I still don't understand most of what he talked about, but what an amazing reality. He created us. He made us what we are. Continuing in verse 14, marvelous are your works, and that my soul knows very well. David says, I know very well your works. I've contemplated my physical existence, the complexity of life. I live in this body. And there's only those with darkened minds who can't comprehend such truth and such revelation. David says, my frame was not hidden from you. Every bone, every muscle in place. He says, this was the case when I was made in secret. This formation of us by God was in secret. It was hidden inside our mother. We can see the development of a fetus through modern technology. But you can't really see, comprehend the creation that's taking place. David says, and skillfully wrought in the lowest parts of the earth. Now, the term here, lowest parts of the earth, is again a symbolic representation of the mother's womb. Verse 16, your eyes saw my substance, yet being unformed. Before we were completely formed, before we were even less than this embryo, God saw our substance. God created our substance. And he says, and in your book, they all were written. We'll come back to that in a moment. Let's go back for a moment to Andrew Cuomo and what happened this week. Seated in a special seat beside Andrew Cuomo when he signed this law authorizing abortion up to the moment of birth last Tuesday was Sarah Weddington, the attorney in the Roe versus Wade case that goes back to 1973 that resulted in the legalization of abortion. And here is the very words of Andrew Cuomo at that moment. He says, with whatever happens in Washington, women in New York will always have the fundamental right to control their own body. That is the justification you will hear over and over and over again for abortion. That women have the right to control their own body. I don't dispute that. What I dispute is that a child at the very earliest moment, even at the moment of conception, is not a part of the woman's body. It is a new body, a new creation, the work of Almighty God in the womb. Yes, there's a connection for the purpose of sustenance through the umbilical cord, but it is not part of the woman's body. Let's think about this logic for a moment. Now let's suppose there is someone in our community, unfortunate as it is, this happens from time to time, let's suppose there's someone in our community that is so depressed and distraught that they are determined to take their own life. And so they're up on a high bridge or up on top of a building about to jump. And of course, everybody gathers around to see the spectacle and they all say, go ahead and jump if you want, your own body. Wait a minute. That's not what they say. In fact, the police and the fire department and the rescue people and everybody converges on the scene to impose upon that poor person their own protection. But society and laws cannot somehow find a way to impose upon an unborn child the same protection. Yes, Mr. Cuomo, I disagree with your logic. We are so perfectly created by God that God chose our parents. Yes. And He chose the very DNA that mom and dad supplied sovereignly to bring about the perfect combination required for His creative genius to bring about our life. You are not a mistake. Some people might wish they had a different set of parents, but you have had the parents God wanted you to have to make you the exact person you are from your personality, your thinking processes, your emotions, and everything that is a part of you as far as the inanimate part, the spiritual part, the soul. Not only has God created us, but He has planned all of our days. Now we come back to where we left off. If I can find that verse here again in a moment, we'll get there. Verse 16, the latter part of the verse. And in your book, they were all written. Now, I know this is a translation here because they didn't have books back in those days. They had scrolls. But it is indicating that God keeps a careful record of everything and He has a perfect plan for everything going forward. I mean, think about the book of life, for example. And those of us that know the Lord Jesus Christ, our name is found in the book of life. It's been there all along. Been there before we were born. Verse 16 continues, the days fashioned for me, when as yet there were none of them. God's plans were in place for us when we were not in existence. Verse 17, David responds to this. He says, how precious also are your thoughts to me, O God. How great is the sum of them. If I should count them, they would be more in number than the sand. Not only did God create us, and not only did He plan our lives, but He is ever mindful of us. And the thoughts that God has about us, the involvement as far as Him knowing what's going on and trying to lead us and correct us and all of that, those thoughts, says David, are too many to number. His concern is far greater than a mother or father's concern for a son or daughter. The capacity is unimaginable. And then he completes verse 18 this way. If I should count them, they would be more, he says, in number than the sand. And then he says this, when I awake, I am still with you. I don't think he's talking about waking up in the morning. I think he's talking about a child when they eventually become conscious of their own being. And spiritually, for those of us that are dead in trespasses and sins, which is the way we were born in this world, spiritually, that moment of waking was at the moment of salvation, spiritually. He planned our existence. Now, this encompasses all that I want to say about God's involvement in our life, which confirms our value. But we have to, as we do with all Scripture, we have to understand how it applies to our life at this moment, and to our decisions and how we live and what we do. And we live here in the midst of a country where 60 million babies have been aborted somewhere in that neighborhood since 1973. And that saddens our hearts and it disturbs us. We live in a world which is a world that has fallen. We live as a minority, believers in God, believers in Jesus Christ, born-again individuals. How are we to respond to all this? What can we do? I think David gives us an answer. It seems out of place almost when you read it without first thought. But look at verse 19. Oh, that you, speaking to God, oh, that you would slay the wicked, O God. Depart from me, therefore, you bloodthirsty men. For they speak against you wickedly. Your enemies take your name in vain. Do I not hate them, O Lord, who hate you? And do I not loathe those who rise up against you? I hate them with a perfect hatred. Count them as my enemies. Now you see, there are those who misunderstand the righteous judgment of God and the righteous indignation of God's people as it relates to that judgment. And to pray this way in public, you won't find it among us, will you? Just a few short weeks ago, a young 13-year-old girl was kidnapped in Fayetteville, assaulted and brutally murdered. I know there'll be some that'll say, Pastor, you don't love people, but I'm telling you the reality. I pretty much knew the outcome, as most of us imagine. And my prayer was that they would find the guilty party and that he'd be fully punished. That is our prerogative. Oh, yeah, we can pray that he be saved too. God's grace is even that big. There's two sides of it. So how does this apply to us in terms of those like, say, for example, Kermit Gosnell, the subject of a film this past year, the physician in Philadelphia. The name of the film, by the way, was Gosnell, The Trial of America's Biggest Serial Killer. He was an abortion doctor. He was convicted of first-degree murder on three counts of infants that were born alive and then killed, of involuntary manslaughter in the death of a patient, 21 felony counts of illegal late-term abortion, and 211 counts of violating the 24-hour informed consent law and put in prison for life. How are we to respond to that? For people that are evil, we need to pray. We need to pray that they will be stopped. We need to pray that they will be punished. We need to pray that God will deal with them. Yes, we can also pray that God might even save them. But for them to be loose on society, that's not acceptable. So we should pray about evil. Pray against evil. Pray for the resolution, the just resolution of evil. You know, I got a book for Christmas. It's a biography of a man by the name of Fritz Grabe. I don't know if I'm pronouncing it right. G-R-A-E or E-A-B-E in German. It may be Grabe. The V, I'm not sure. The title of the book is The Moses of Rovno. And I don't even know if I'm pronouncing that right. It's a city in the Ukraine. The Moses of Rovno. Fritz Grabe. He was a German man who was taught to be empathetic for others because of his Christian faith and the Christian faith of his parents. He worked as an engineer construction during World War II under the Nazi regime. And he used his company as a front. He did the construction work too, but as a front also to save many Jews, help them escape. In reading the book, I was unprepared for what I read. I knew about the concentration camps. I knew about the total deaths. I wasn't prepared for what I read in this book. In the Ukraine, city after city, the Jews were segregated and they had to live in a ghetto by themselves. So in city after city, they surrounded those ghettos with police and soldiers, and they rounded up every single Jew. In the process, they murdered babies in front of the parents. They rounded him up and they herded him to a place outside of town where they had dug a huge mass grave. They made them take their clothes off and jump in that grave. And then soldiers on the side shot them one by one. City after city. I didn't know it went to that extent. And I'm reading the book, and at one point I put the book down and I didn't even go back to it for several days because I was so overwhelmed emotionally with what I had read. And I asked myself, I said, how can people that live next door went to church together, whatever they did, how could that have happened? Even if there were evil people, how could it have happened? How could so many people have participated? How could so many people have looked the other way? I don't know. I puzzled over that. And then it dawned on me. It's exactly what's happening in America today in the matter of abortion. No, I'm not saying we are complicit. We do what we can. We vote, hopefully, as we should. We march when we have the opportunity. We observe Sanctity of Human Life Sunday. We try to advise, counsel, help people to make different choices. But overall, what happened in Germany and in the Ukraine has happened here. And far, far more in numbers have died. And people like Andrew Cuomo says, well, we're so happy about it. But David's not finished. Another practical application. And it too kind of strikes you as odd at first until you put it together in your mind. He says in verse 23, "Search me, O God, and know my heart. Try me and know my anxieties. And see if there be any wicked way in me, and lead me in the way everlasting." David was a bold and powerful man, someone nobody wanted to meet on the battlefield, a man who boldly prayed all those imprecatory prayers you read in the Psalms, part of which we've just looked at. But David had also learned lessons about his own spirit and his own soul, his own tendency to do wrong, and to be complicit in sin, have to be rebuked by a prophet, even to the point of losing his son over it. I'm not real sure where this psalm falls chronologically, was before or after the whole thing with Bathsheba, but his life in general, David realized, you always have to look at yourself first. My friends, we have to search our own hearts. We have to be willing then to let God show us where we're wrong. We have to be open to confessing our own sins before we can be of any use in a world full of sin. We have to pull the log out of our own eye before we can do anything to help someone find that speck that's obscuring their vision. Be it a woman waiting to make an abortion, or be it society in general who can't see it for their blindness. We need to eagerly welcome God's correction and discipline in our own lives. And then and only then might we have an opportunity to make a difference in somebody else's life. For you see, when we stand here and condemn abortion, remember Jesus said, if you're angry with your brother, you're guilty of murder. In other words, he equated the two in terms of motivation, inward thoughts. Now, obviously, we do not punish people who are murderers in their thoughts. Otherwise, there would be nobody alive, right? We'd all be dead by now. We do deal with action. But we always need to practice self-examination.